Do you know we're now 11 days into this year and it's 3% of the year has gone? It sounds weird to think 3% of the year is gone already. It doesn't feel like it's been that long. But we're also 2 months into Shelby and I now being the senior pastors here at Como. And even though Shelby and I have been here for the last 3 years, it would be understandable if some of you are kind of thinking, okay, well, you've been around, but we don't know too much of your background. We only know the last 3 years of your life. And who are you? How did you get here? All those sorts of things. And so over the next couple of weeks, Shelby and I are both going to share our stories. We're going to give you just a little bit of a snapshot of who we are, how we came to be here at Como, some of the highlights of what God has done in our lives, not just so you can get a chronological story of us. In fact, I'm going to leave 90% of it out because we only have this time this morning, but so that you can sort of get a capture an idea of the things God has been working in us over our years and what led us to be here at Como. And as we do that, maybe it will inspire you to think about your story and how God has been working in your life over your entire years of being on this earth, and also how God has been working in this church and framing the story of Como Baptist over the 90-something years that we've been operating as a church. And maybe that would even feed into Vision Day as well. At our commissioning service, Steve preached and talked about this proverb that has been meaningful to me that ever since I heard it in Bible college, and it was interesting that he chose to use it because it's something that stood out for me. But it's a Portuguese proverb, and it says this: God writes straight with crooked lines. Sorry, Rob, this isn't working at the moment. Thanks, mate. It says, God writes straight with crooked lines. You might remember Steve talking about that. And it's got some echoes and basis in Ecclesiastes 7:13, which says, consider what God has done. Who can straighten what he has made crooked? And that saying has given me a bit of language to be able to understand what is it that God has been doing throughout my life. Because when I look back and I see the journey that I've taken, it has not been a straight path. It has gone in ways that I didn't expect and didn't intend for things to go. But God has been faithful across that journey. And I've discovered a God that I can trust, and a God that often understood what was going on before I had a clue what was happening. And to be honest, I never planned to be here today. I never planned to be a pastor. That was never my dream. I always assumed I was going to work in IT, to be honest. Ministry wasn't part of my plan. But yet, as I look over my life, I can see how God has been quietly guiding and shaping me and Shelby for this role that we have today. To help us get a bit of a concept as we start to think about the idea of God riding straight with crooked lines, I want you to just consider for a moment the story of Joseph in Genesis. You remember the story of Joseph? His story was full of very sharp and crooked turns. And he was a guy who went from being the favored son to being sold by his brothers into slavery. He was then wrongly accused for something he didn't do, sent into prison, and then forgotten about and left languishing there. And Joseph had no idea how these moments in his life would have been connected. And I don't think at any point in prison did Joseph know that he was being prepared to one day lead the nation of Egypt and save them from famine. Also, I don't believe God wanted or planned all that cruelty for Joseph that he experienced, but I do believe that God was not absent in Joseph's life. And that as Joseph's life unfolded, God was able to guide it as it moved forwards and guide his story and prepare him and shape him, even though Joseph couldn't see at the time how it all fit together. I also don't want you to think that maybe God has planned every painful turn in your story. Anything that's gone wrong in your life, I don't think God wanted that cruelty for you either. But I do want you to consider, how did God perhaps be present in those moments? What were you able to learn in those times? How was God comforting you? Maybe how was he shaping you or preparing you for where you actually are now, or maybe where you are heading soon? This is the lens I'm using as I look over my life. And as I think about my story this morning, and as I share, obviously I'm not going to share everything, but I'm going to share some of the highlight moments of where God prepared me when I felt unqualified or uncertain about the future or scared or even just feeling stretched beyond what I thought I could handle. So let's go to the very start. I was born in Gosford, New South Wales on the central coast, about an hour or so north of Sydney. And I grew up in a Christian home. My dad was a pastor. And I remember when I was about 4 or 5 years old, remembering walking down the hallway of our house and just stopping and praying, dear Jesus, please come into my heart, like with my hands like that. I don't remember what prompted that. I just knew, because you know when you grow up in a Christian home and you're at church all the time, you have to ask Jesus into your heart. So I did that at 5 years old. At 10 years old, my dad accepted a call to become the pastor at Rockingham Baptist Church here in WA. So we packed up the family, moved from Sydney and came here to Perth. And then two pivotal moments happened for me in my faith in my adolescent years. When I was 12, I actually got convicted by the Holy Spirit and realized, you know what, I actually need to make a choice to follow Jesus for myself, not just call myself a Christian culturally because I'd been brought up that way or my whole family was a Christian. And so when I was 12 is when I say that's the time I was converted, that Jesus became real for me and I actually made a conscious decision, hey, I'm going to follow you for the rest of my life. So that happened to me when I was 12. The other pivotal moment for me was when I was 15, I went on a youth camp with a whole bunch of my friends from church, and that was an amazing camp, and it ignited something within me. It ignited in me a passion for Jesus, and it did for my friends as well. When we all came back from that camp, everyone noticed there was a difference in us. One of the comments that was, oh, they're actually carrying their Bibles around, and they're actually reading them. That kind of thing changed for us. Like, church became real. It wasn't just a place where we hung out in the back rows and were the weird kids at the back that were just making nonsense. No, we suddenly became the kids that sat in the middle rows. We weren't front row yet. Lifting our hands in worship, praying. We started a Bible study for ourselves. That was a moment where my faith really became alive and I started to actually pursue Jesus with a real heart. I got baptized soon after that and started to serve in church in different forms of ministry. Throughout high school, I developed two keen interests. One was music. I played trumpet in the school band. Don't ask me to play it now. My embouchure is many years out of date. I actually do have my trumpet. It's in my shed. I can't bear to get rid of it. But I tried playing it when we moved. It doesn't make a noise anymore. But then I also started playing bass guitar at church. And that was my foray into worship music. And the other interest for me was computers. I loved building them. You think about the late 90s where computers were just really on the edge as you tried to extract every last bit of speed out of them. I loved to pull them apart, put them back together, push them to the edge, overclock them, wipe them every so often and reinstall the operating system, much to my family's frustration because that was the computer we all used. But that was one of my passions that came out and developed for me. So it wasn't a surprise to anyone when I decided I was going to go to university and study computer science and hopefully pursue a job in the IT industry. And after I graduated, I ended up working at my old high school, of all places to work, and looked after the IT network there and supporting teachers through their IT needs. In the meantime, on the church side of things, Dad's time at Rockingham Church finished, and he ended up taking a call at Maidervale Baptist. And so we moved to Maidervale, and that was the church that I committed into, and I served there and got involved leading youth group and leading and playing on the worship teams and leading a Bible study there and was very involved in Maidervale for the years that I was there. In 2005, so what would I have been, 21 at that point, my dad decided that was going to be ending for him and he'd accepted a call to a church in Tasmania. So he decided we're going to move to Tasmania across the country. And the family was getting ready to pack up and move. And I was like, you know what? I've just started my life here. I've just started establishing my roots. I've just finished my degree. I've just started a job. I don't really want to move. And so a difficult decision was made that I was going to stay here in Perth as the rest of my family moved to Tasmania. So I stayed here in Perth, and that was where things were. In 2006, so the next year, the new senior pastor at Maidervale, his name was Florian. He'd observed the way that I'd been serving and leading at church, and he said to me, hey, have you ever considered being a pastor or entering some kind of vocational ministry? And my perhaps too quick answer was, no, absolutely not. I don't want to do that. Never, never, ever ask me that again. That was something I'm not interested in. Because the reasons for that were I didn't feel like it was for me. I'd seen the toll that had taken on my parents as my dad had been a pastor. And also my dad had said something to me when I was quite young. He said, Ben, never enter ministry, never become a pastor or a missionary unless you are certain that God has called you into it. And since I hadn't felt I'd been called into it, I wasn't going to do it. So I said to Florian, no, not for me. And that was fine. Maybe about a year later, Florian came to me again and he said, Ben, I can't shake this idea. I'm just going to ask you the same question again. Have you ever considered being a pastor? And while again I said, no, Florian, the answer's still the same. The thought lingered with me this time. And I started thinking, what if God did want me to be a pastor? But there was no certainty for me. And thinking, you know what, if God's going to call me, he's going to make this really obvious. And so I didn't tell anyone about this at the time. I was like, I'm just going to wait and see what God says. Later on, I was at a youth camp conference with the youth group, and the speaker that night got up and he was preaching. I don't even remember the topic he was preaching, but there was this line that stood out to me ever since. And he said, "In this room are the next generation of pastors in Perth." And as he said that, something stirred in me here. And I was like, "Oh, is that you, God? Is that, are you trying to tell me something?" Oh, if he is, I'm not qualified for this. There's no way I could do that. Besides, if God wants me to do this, he's going to make it really obvious. Around that time, I started getting enamored with the story of Gideon. And if you're familiar with the story of Gideon, he is a man who very much felt unqualified to do what God called him to do. He was the lowest of the lowest tribe in Israel and felt like, who am I to lead anybody? And part of Gideon's story was he just wanted to make sure, hey, if God is asking me to do something, I'm going to do some tests. And he laid out fleeces, and you can read that story in the book of Judges to find out what he did. But through that process, he discerned, okay, God is telling me to do this thing. And as I read that story, I was like, okay, if I'm starting to think about this pastor idea, I'm going to lay out some fleeces. What could I do to ask God to confirm to me what it is he's saying, if he's saying it at all? And the best I could come up with at the time was saying, okay, God, if I hear the same words coming out of different people's mouth about this pastor thing from several different people who don't know each other, are not connected, cannot collude with each other, clearly separate people, then maybe I'll believe it's you saying this to me. And somehow I was still surprised when that started happening. Several different people started coming to me and saying this thing that was completely different from each other. I had a housemate who had recently given up a job and gone to Bible college and was studying to be a pastor. And we were talking one night and he said, "Hey, Ben, have you ever thought about doing the same thing? Have you ever thought about being a pastor?" Later, I was catching up with an old friend, and as we shared what we'd been up to since high school, they said to me, "Hey, it sounds like you'd be a great pastor. Have you ever considered being a pastor?" So those keeping score, that's now three people who have said that to me. In mid-2008, God hadn't made it obvious to me yet, obviously. In mid-2008, I managed to go on a mission exposure trip with my church. We went to Romania for a month. And Romania is such a beautiful country, and I'd love to unpack everything we did in that month. But it was a kind of a group that went in two halves. One half was, "Oh, that's not cool. That's okay. She'll be all right." The group that went to Romania, the group was kind of in two halves. There was a whole bunch of older adults, I'd love to say they were really old, but I think they're my age now. Couple of plus 40 people. There was me, this 23-year-old, and then there was a whole bunch of teenagers, and these teenagers were the kids of the older adults. And me being one of the key youth leaders at the church, I got on really well with the teenagers. So I spent a lot of my time with them as we went through all the things we did during that trip. And on that trip, we inadvertently connected with an English couple who were English missionaries to Romania. And they were serving there at the time, and they connected with us and ended up joining us for the month as we went around and did our things. And on one of the last nights we were in Romania, they took me aside and they said, "Hey, Ben, we've been watching you this month. And as you worked with the teens and the kids we've been interacting with and all the different people, are you their youth pastor? Because like you seem to have some gifting there. Oh, you're not? Have you ever considered becoming a pastor?" By this time, I started to get the message. I'm like, "God, if you've given me this conversation with someone from the other side of the world, meeting in Romania to have that conversation, okay, God, maybe that is you." God was being patient while I caught up. And there were even more instances of that conversation happening, many more instances of things being confirmed. But by then, they were just affirming what I already knew, that God was calling me to become a pastor. But I still had all these fears and all these reasons why I shouldn't do it, why I couldn't do it. I didn't feel good enough. I'm not a charismatic leader by nature. That's something that's grown in me. I didn't want to give up my career and my stable job that I had. I didn't want to lose financial security. I didn't want to start over again and go back to study again, having already established my degree. I was scared. I'm like, "God, how on earth am I going to do this?" And when I returned from Romania, it was late Saturday night, and as a group, we decided, "Hey, let's not go back to church tomorrow morning. We're pretty tired. Let's go back the next week so that we can, you know, do our big return and share the stories then." So I didn't go to church the next morning, but I went and visited another church on Sunday night. And at that service that night, the preacher there was preaching from Joshua chapter 1, where Joshua was getting ready to take over from Moses and begin leading the Israelites. And in Joshua 1 verse 9, God says this to Joshua. He says, "Be strong and courageous." Sorry, Rob, we're now both trying to press it at the same time. "Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. The preacher was actually talking about stepping out into the call that God has on your life. And if you are scared about it, don't be afraid, because God gave this promise to Joshua and he gives it to you as well. That if God has called you to something, he will be with you wherever you go. And I really felt like that night God was telling me, I know you don't think you're good enough. I know that you think that you're not ready. You're scared of the unknown, but you don't have to be afraid, because I'm going to walk every step of the journey with you. Which was huge for me to hear. And so I resolved to myself that night, okay, when I find Florin again, we're going to have that chat about being a pastor for reals. Weird coincidence, Florin visited that same church that night and we ran into each other in the foyer. And he says, Ben, I felt God telling me tonight we have to have that conversation about being a pastor again. I mean, funny coincidence. And so we had those conversations and things started to unfold from there. And so I stepped out and I enrolled at Vos Seminary. And I went to my boss and I said to him, hey, I'm going to quit at the end of the year. I'm going to Bible college. I'm going to be a pastor. And that made it real for me that it was all happening, that I actually took the steps to undo my current life to get ready for the new one. But I was still really concerned how it was all going to pan out. I didn't have a job lined up. I didn't know what I was going to do. But then God started his provision. Once I stepped out, things started falling into place. The very next week, my boss called me back into his office and said, Ben, as we get a new person on board to run the IT, would you consider coming back a couple of days a week and just as a casual assist that new person? And, you know, you can flex it around whatever days you're studying, change it every semester, whatever days you have to be there. And I was like, wow, that's amazing. I'm going to have this job that I'm familiar with and don't have to relearn and can just slot in with things. That was amazing. And then I got an unexpected decent tax return that year, which gave me a buffer to get started for that new year that was coming. And then someone in the church came to me and said, I know you're going to Bible college. I'd love to sponsor you somehow. And so they gave me some Coles vouchers every week just to help offset my living expenses. All of a sudden, my fears about finance were taken care of. Yeah, of course, I wasn't going to have as much money as I did before, but I had definitely enough to cover my rent and my living expenses and getting through the next foreseeable future. It was enough at the right time. And as it all fell into place, I knew God was saying, see, all you had to do was trust me. I've got this. I will go with you. I have called you. You can trust me. But none of it happened until I followed him and stepped out into those places of following his call, taking the risks. And while it might have taken a while for me to step out, I'm thankful that God was faithful as I was still figuring it all out. Psalm 37 says this. It says, the Lord makes firm the steps of the one who delights in him, and though he may stumble, he will not fall, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. And I learned through that period that when I'm on face, I am facing an uncertain future, or certainly as I move forward, I can trust God. And trusting God is not believing that nothing's ever going to go wrong and that I'll never stumble, but believing that he will be with me, holding my hand as I walk towards his calling, helping me to find the right path. While I was studying, I had dreams of becoming the youth pastor at Maida Vale, and that was kind of what got me into this idea of being a pastor, like seeing these kids I'd been working with, and oh, if I could just be their pastor, that would be amazing. But unfortunately, the church was not in a position to employ me, so that never really happened. But about a year into being at Bible college, I was approached with the chance to become the worship pastor at Carey Baptist Church. And even though Maida Vale couldn't employ me, I went to Florin and said, I've got this opportunity, but I still feel loyal to Maida Vale. And he said, no, if someone is willing to pay you to do your job as a minister and be a pastor, go for it. So I felt released and I went and I joined Carey. And I joined their staff team and started to learn about all the things that go on behind the scenes in running a church. And I loved being a worship pastor, but I still had that passion for youth inside me. It's what I felt God had called me to in the first place. And so I just sort of thought, okay, I'm biding my time. I'm not going to just like use this as a stepping stone. I'm going to pour everything into it. But if something comes up, you never know, I might switch to being a youth pastor somewhere. After a couple of years, Carey decided they were going to employ a second youth pastor to work alongside Nick. Nick was dual vocationing both as a school teacher at Carey and the youth pastor. But his school commitments were growing, and so he said, hey, I want to give up some of my Carey time, and can we employ someone else and we'll work together as a team? And I thought, hey, that sounds pretty good, and that's kind of the passion I had. So I put up my hand and switched from being worship pastor to youth pastor and took over from Nick solo after a few years when his teaching commitments grew even more. And my time at Kerry was very formative for me. I absolutely loved that place, and I learned so much about leadership and systems and teams and especially myself, more than any other season to that point. It was very growing and shaping for me. And while it stretched me, it also revealed areas where God had been reshaping me, both in how I lead and how I see myself as a person. One of the key moments for me came as we were running the youth group. And I was looking at it. And at this point, the youth ministry had 200 kids coming on a Friday night, which from the outside looks amazing and fantastic. We even had other youth groups coming to visit us going, what's your model? How do you do this? How do you have such a huge ministry? The secret is have a school attached and funnel them in that way. But actually, that's not what was happening. Most of the kids from our school didn't want to come. No one from our church wanted to come. They were all coming from down the road for a different school. But discipleship wasn't happening there, and most of the attendees were just coming for a good time. It was a safe place that parents could drop their kids off at. No one engaged in the preaching. No one was being part of the small groups. In fact, small groups were pretty much a waste of time, and they were very unproductive. Kids would just put up with the God part of the night just to enjoy hanging out with their friends. And Shelby and I stood back one week, and we stood back on the edge, and we just went, would we ever send our kids to this youth group? And when both of us said no, we knew there was a problem. And so we went through a significant review process, and we spent much time in prayer and reevaluating our goals as what our youth ministry should be and what we believe God wanted for it to be doing. And after a six-month period, we ended up closing the youth group, shut it down, because we wanted to reboot it. And we wanted to start again. And that was huge for us because so many people on the outside couldn't understand, why would you close a youth ministry that seems so successful, like 200 kids, like surely you're doing something right. But what I learned through that process was numerical success doesn't equate fruitfulness. And sometimes obedience means shutting down something that has been effective in the past and but has run its course. And now it's time to change focus. And that was a long, hard journey to go through because, you know, that is part of your identity. Like, I'm the youth pastor of a 200-plus youth group. Look at me. Oh, I closed it. And people had questions. And having to explain to them the journey that God was taking us on was difficult for people to understand who weren't part of it and weren't seeing the issues we were seeing. But eventually we restarted it with a group of 20 kids from the church. 20 is a far cry from 200. It's a lot easier, but it's a huge change. But we slowly let that youth group grow again, and it was based around discipleship at its core. And by the time we reached the 100 mark again, it was a very different culture in that youth ministry. People were being discipled, and people were engaging and worshiping and growing in their faith. And it's been a much more productive thing to be able to hand over. I'll pause on my career story there for a moment, talk a little bit about Shelby. She's amazing. The end. Now, I met Shelby at Vos while I was studying. And I mean, she was in different classes to me. She was a little bit younger. She was studying over in the vet sector. So our paths didn't cross too much. But her dad worked at BCWA, and I needed to go talk to BCWA about pastoral accreditation. And he was the person you had to go see. So I went and sat in his office to ask, how do I get into the stream and how do I pursue being accredited as a Baptist minister? But I was really nervous because he's like a big head honcho. Like, I've seen him on stage at all the Baptist events. And like, how do you talk to one of these amazing BCWA people? So I'm sitting there like not moving in his office. And he goes, all right. I found out later his thinking was, I'm just going to break the ice with this guy, make some jokes, relax him, and we'll be able to talk. He said, hey, Ben, do you like dogs? I'm like, yeah, dogs are good. He goes, yeah, cool. Do you know my daughter Shelby? She goes to Vos. I'm like, oh, yeah, I've seen her around. He goes, yeah, she's got a dog. And I always told her that if she got a dog, she had to take it with her. So if you marry my daughter and take that dog, I'll fast-track this accreditation for you and we'll be sorted. He quit before I finished, and now I'm stuck with a dog. No, he's a good dog. He's a great dog. That night, he went home and told Shelby what he'd done, expecting a laugh, and Shelby was horrified. And she messaged me through Facebook, the first time we'd ever really spoken, just profusely apologizing. I'm so sorry for my dad. He's crazy. I'm like, it's okay. I've got a crazy dad too. And then that was all cool. But then we kept talking. And we kept messaging, and then we started hanging out between classes at Vos. And we started to become friends, and we started to talk about our life stories and our trajectories and our dreams. And they really seemed to align really well. And then we discovered that we seemed to complement each other in so many ways. She's amazing in areas where I'm weakest, and our strengths go together really well. And eventually all of this led to us dating and getting engaged and then getting married. And we lived on site at Vos for about 5 years, which is kind of fitting because we met there and we got engaged there and we had our wedding there and we had our first kid there. It's a very special place for us. And every time we drive past it, we say, Micah, that's your first house, as we go driving past. But as any good marriage and partnership should, marriage helped expose blind spots that I couldn't see on my own of who I am as a person. And some of our early conflicts led to marriage counseling, and I began to learn that my value didn't need to come from me being the most performative person out there, that I didn't need to be the most incredible husband and the most amazing youth pastor anyone's ever seen, but that my value comes from the fact that I am a child of God, and all that other stuff about being amazing can come out of that. But that was huge for me to learn, because everything in my life to that point was performative. Like, if I'm not the best at this, if I'm not great at that, then surely I'm failing. And then when it wasn't working, it would just shake me to my core, and all sorts of things would happen. But learning that truth, that as a child of God, that is who I am and that's where my value comes from, was transformational. It transformed our marriage. It transformed my career. It transformed everything. And I learned that trusting God sometimes means letting other people help you to see the things that you can't see. There's many parts of our story that I could share, and many parts that God has been active in our marriage. And I want to highlight just maybe two of these significant times where God's taught me to trust him, but there have been so many more. Micah was born in mid-2018, and the pregnancy was rough and difficult on Shelby, and it was compounded even more by the fact that we were going through the public system and in a hospital that was brand new and still sorting out itself and its processes. It was a difficult journey getting there, but even on the birthday, things went wrong. It wasn't as smooth as we'd hoped. And I mean, what pregnancy birth is smooth? But, you know, things actually did go wrong and plans were thrown out the window. And after a very difficult 24 hours, the baby was in distress and they decided we're going to go into an unplanned C-section that we never wanted. So we're being rushed in there and everything's just a blur. Anxiety is through the roof. My fear is soaring. This is not what we wanted. What's going to happen? The baby's distressed. How is this all going to play out? And then even in the surgery, the things were going wrong. The anesthetic wasn't taking and things were getting delayed as that was trying to be sorted out. And then I remember feeling scared and worried in that moment, but until God said to me, I've got something for you. And he popped a song into my head. It's that song, No Longer Slaves. I'm no longer a slave to fear, but I am a child of God. So I'm going to break up here. And that song reminds us that even in our most scared moments, even when we're worried about what's going on, God has us in his hands. And I started singing it over Shelby, and even the anaesthetist has heard, and she goes, no, keep doing that, it's helping her relax. Shelby doesn't remember this part. She was all out of it. But as I sang that song in the operating theater, I was reminded that God has this. And my fear started to fade away. And then the baby was born, and things were okay. But that the emotion of that moment, as you can sort of see, and the lesson that was learned come rushing back every time that song is played for me, which is why when people ask, why don't you ever want to sing that song on stage? That's why. I love that song. I love that we sing it, but I'm never going to lead it because I will cry. But the emotion and the learning of that day was significant for me. And throughout parenting, again and again, we've had to learn to trust God because our parenting has not been anything like what we expected. The whole baby phase was a difficult period for us. The child was in constant pain and crying 24/7. He was getting overwhelmed at church just by not only just the normal services, even the big ones. I mean, the big ones are understandable, but just normal church. Oh, what's going on here? He wasn't hitting milestones the way he should, and we were getting concerned that his cousin seemed to be accelerating so fast and he wasn't developing in the same way and they were the same age. But we didn't know everything that was going on at the time. We didn't know he was celiac. We didn't know about his autism, and every doctor and nurse offered suggestions. It's just colic. It's just a phase. Take some omeprazole. He'll grow out of it. You just need to breastfeed better. Oh, maybe try this formula. Try this new technique. Do this, do that. And none of it worked until one doctor started asking some interesting questions. Then he said, I think your kid might be a celiac. I mean, you can't test for that when he's under two, but try that. So we switched to a gluten-free diet, and overnight, almost, his screaming stopped. But we just kept getting told we had a difficult child because the celiac is one thing, everything else was another. And being told you have a difficult child, I mean, that hurts, but it just still didn't sound right. Like, no. And eventually, through a long process, we found out we were dealing with something called PDA, pathological demand avoidance. PDA is something that many people don't know about or don't understand, and so I'll try to explain it in one sentence. Living with PDA means that whenever you feel pressured, or someone tells you to do something or asks you to do something, like a normal parent would, your brain goes into panic mode. The fight or flight response kicks in, and you literally freeze up, or you chuck a meltdown, or everything goes wrong, your brain can't engage, which is really strange because it's like, I just asked you to put your toys away. I asked you to stand up and go to the room. I asked you to move that so you can then have ice cream. But no, the brain freezes right up. And it completely changes how you actually have to parent with a person with PDA. You have to do it a lot more collaboratively and give them more freedom and choice. But for us, we've discovered that the way we expected to parent, the way that all the parenting books tell you to do it, none of it works. And the best metaphor I found was written by Emily Pearl Kingsley. And it's like this. Imagine you've booked a trip to Italy. And in this metaphor, booking a trip to Italy is having kids. You've read all the guidebooks. You've learned a few phrases in Italian. You've dreamed of the food and the sights and the way of life that's coming. And everyone you know talks about Italy. Italy's great. You're going to love it. Yeah, it's going to be difficult getting there. But once you're in Italy, it's going to be amazing. Like, you've got to make sure you go see the Colosseum. Do this, do that. And they give you tips about what to do when you're in Rome and when you visit Florence. But when the plane lands, you walk out of the airport and there's a sign that says, "Welcome to Holland." And you're like, what? Now, Holland isn't bad. Holland has windmills and tulips and a quiet beauty of its own, but it's not Italy. And at first there's grief because you'd planned and dreamed of going to Italy for so long. And the hardest part is everyone else keeps acting as if you are in Italy. And they give you Italian maps and they give you Italian guidebooks and they judge you for not enjoying the Italian lifestyle or the Italian food. And they say, you just got to get out more. You just got to press into this thing. You're going to love Italy, but you're in Holland. And parenting a kid with PDA and celiac or any special needs, really, it's a bit like that. You aren't in the place you plan to be or you expected to be, and you're in this completely different space that it seems like no one else understands that you're living in Holland, not Italy. And as you learn about Holland and unpack that and learn its language and its rhythms and its way of life and its beauty, you start to see how amazing Holland is and you love it and you learn how to live differently there. Even while the world around you insists that you're in Italy and tells you you need to live that way. Now, Holland is not a punishment. Holland is just a different destination. I share that story for two reasons. One, so you kind of understand some of the stuff we do, but also to give you a glimpse into the fact that this was something that really reshaped my brain. Because I had to learn how to parent differently to what I'd planned to. And I had to learn to trust God's provision because there's so much going on in that story that I've left out that only God could have actually made happen. The ways that we finally connected with the right people and all that sort of stuff. And so somehow I had to learn to accept the future is not what I imagined, but it's still just as beautiful. And that shaped me in so many ways. Like, my heart and empathy for others has grown immensely. Like, learning that the assumptions you make about other people's journeys are often wrong. And even the way I lead has changed because of it. Even though the road we have journeyed to get to where we are today with both our kids has been rocky and definitely not smooth, God has been faithful in providing what we needed. Often in moments when we felt like we're at the end of our rope and thought everything was going to collapse at any moment, God has provided for us, opening doors to help and assistance that we didn't even know we could access. When we started talking about having a sibling for Micah, we wanted to, but we were concerned about going through the pregnancy process again. We really had traumatic memories of the first time around. But through another God incident in our life, he managed to connect us with the head of midwifery in WA. And we shared with her our story and said, you know, this is what we experienced and we don't want to do that again. What are the other options? I mean, we could go the private route and try that, but, you know, that's still even expensive and we can't afford most of that. But, you know, what's out there? What could we do different this time? And she revealed a program that had been quietly launched that aimed to bridge a gap between the public and private experiences that and dealt with difficult pregnancies. And it provided continuity of care and private level treatment, but at minimal cost, which sounds way too good to be true. Partly because it is. But we applied for the program and we managed to get in. And the pregnancy experience with Lucas was so different to the first time around. having the same doctor see you each time and building a relationship that they know you and they understand everything that's going on, having a small, quiet clinic you can visit near your house, having people who genuinely cared for you and worked on you with a plan and tracked and cared for you throughout the whole way, meeting with the actual obstetricians who would be in the room with you at the birth. Like, this was what we needed. This is what was so different to the first time around. Until the birth date. This had been amazing to get into this program, and it was so incredibly God provision for us that we were able to do this. And to, I think we paid $900 for the entire process from conception to delivery. It was amazing. But on the birth date, Shelby was booked in to have a C-section on the Wednesday. On the Monday morning, Shelby wakes me up at about 6:30 in the morning and goes, "Ben, I think my water's just broke. I think we have to go to hospital." In my half-asleep state, I'm like, "I haven't packed my bags. No, go back to sleep," and rolled over. And she goes, "Ben, no," and pushes me. So we were off to hospital on the Monday, heading in there. And thankfully, things went relatively smoothly. We didn't get the obstetrician we planned. His backup came and did the surgery. But his birth was an absolute way more smoother process. I think actually the biggest complication was I didn't have breakfast and almost collapsed. And the nurse was like, "Get out, I'm not serving two people here in this operating theatre." So I went out and got some biscuits. Anyway, that's not part of the story I'd written down. Things went smoothly with Lucas, and he was born 2 days earlier than we planned. But what we found out later that day was the program had gone into receivership. Turns out offering private level care on a public level budget isn't sustainable. And we were literally the last birth to happen in that program. If Shelby's waters hadn't broken and we had waited until the Wednesday, it's possible that our plans had been in complete jeopardy. We might not have been able to get into that private hospital. We might not have been able to have the care that we'd hoped for. And so we thank and praise God that he was able to connect us with the head of midwifery and help us get into this exclusive program and then have this experience that almost redeemed the first time round, and to even coordinate things that Shelby's waters would break early so we'd still have the full experience. God taught me again, "Hey, I'm with you." So now we had both our kids. And then a major shift happened for us. My time at Carey was coming to an end. The Carey organization, including the church and the school and the daycare and all the amazing parts of Carey and the wonderful place that is, has evolved. And eventually it became clear that as Carey had changed, I had changed as well. And while I could still function in the Carey environment, they were moving a different direction to the way I'm shaped. And I wasn't best wired to lead the youth ministry there in the long term. The pace and shape of ministry at Carey did some great things for me. It stretched me and grew me, and it also revealed both my strengths but also my limits. And the future direction of Carey and the way I'm shaped were no longer aligned, which was deeply painful to realize, but also strangely clarifying. Painful because I've invested 13 years of my life in that place and loved the people and loved what that place does. And sad to say I'm going to be leaving this, but also clarifying because it made me realize, oh, okay, God has me shaped for something different. Now, this is the 3 years on version of the story, 4 years on version of the story that has been well processed and unpacked. But that started as a new season of uncertainty again and trusting God for us of what is next. Because deciding you're going to leave a church with no other church to go to lined up is quite a scary prospect. It's like, well, it is quitting your job with nowhere to go. We both still felt called to be pastors, so we were like, okay, we're going to pursue still being a pastor somewhere. But there aren't many vacancies out there, especially vacancies where they want two pastors, particularly a husband and wife in some way, where even if we wanted different roles of youth and kids or whatever, there weren't many opportunities out there. So we went to BCWA at the Baptist office, and we met with Jackie, who was the person at the time who'd taken over from Steve after he left. And she was the person that you speak to about pastoral vacancies and all that sort of stuff. And so we unpacked our story for her, and she talked us through the process we would go through as we wrapped things up at Carey and started looking for new churches, and got us in the part of the program where you have to fill out all these forms that say, yes, I'm a pastor and these are my gifts and abilities, so they could use that to help shop us around to other churches. But then she called us back into her office a few days later and she said, "Hey, I'm taking my BCWA hat off and I'm putting my Como hat on. There might be an opportunity here." And I'll leave you in suspense for how that turned out. But only to say God knew what he was doing as he was closing the doors at Carey and opening up a door here. Now, I've just shared my highlight reels, and that sounds like, even me as I'm saying, I'm going, this sounds amazing. Like, God is amazing and loud speaking and clearly at work in Ben's life. How do I even measure up to that? No, I'm giving you the highlights. there's long periods of, God, what are you doing? There's long periods of silence. There's long periods of things not going the way I wanted. But looking back over my life, even though it's never been obvious at the time, as I'm living through it all, in hindsight, I can see God's fingerprints all over it. So I'm able to share a highlight reel and go, God was doing this, God was doing that. And even though we're pastors and we've been through all these stories and more, God still surprises me in this area of provision and learning to trust him. Many of you are aware of the story of us buying a house last year or the story of us finding the right school for our kids. Both of those have God's fingerprints all over it, just in the timing and the provision and the way that he brought people around us. And God once again saying, hey, I've got this. You don't see many steps ahead, but I do. Trust me and walk the steps that I've opened up before you. Which is hard to do because I like to see the start to the end so I know exactly where I'm walking. When God says here's only steps 1, 2, and 3 of 4,000, that's a bit rough. But learning to say, okay, God, I know you've illuminated these 3 steps. I will walk them has been a long-learnt lesson. It hasn't been a straight path, and I've left many parts of the story out. There's only so much I can fit into this morning. In fact, I think I've gone long already. But as I trace the journey of my life, God has taken so many different lines and so many different ways that I could have gone. And he's been writing a story in me through it all, that if you like a scattergraph, you draw the line through, you see where God has been pointing the whole time. At first, all these stories and these twists don't seem super connected, but God writes a story that gets me to where I am today. Sometimes in spite of me. Sometimes I'm taking a while to figure things out, but God is patient and faithful and working through all of it. And I know he's not finished in me yet. The things he has to shape me and teach me next, I don't know what they are. But I've grown to a point where if I'm sitting in the middle of the unknown or sitting in the middle of, I have no idea how I'm going to make this work. God, what is the next direction? I know I can trust him. I know it. And when I get to the other side and turn around and look back, I often then see God's fingerprints all over it. Now, do I think I'm special that I get this special treatment and you don't? No, not at all. I think you are just as validly ready to receive the same from God. Because I do believe that God is at work guiding our steps and writing stories through all of our crooked lines. It's a bit like, you know, that old poem that became really popular about 30 years ago, the Footprints poem? And when it talks about, you know, walking with the Lord and 2 sets of footprints, and you turn back and you go, hey, in those difficult times, why is there only 1 set of footprints? And Jesus says, yeah, they're the times that I carried you. And even though we still have to walk through difficult times and the pain that comes with them, God walks with us through them. And sometimes he carries us. Sometimes he drags us, but he will carry us. And just as I look back and see God's hand at work in my life, I know God's been shaping yours too. And in a few weeks, we're going to talk about tracing our own stories and seeing how God has been at work in all of us together. But today, as we walk out, perhaps with your new arm knowledge of some of my story, maybe you'll notice the unexpected twists in your own life where God has used them or comforted you or guided you through them. Things that he's used to teach you or shape you or prepare you for what's now or even what's coming next. And as you think about your own story, just ask yourself the question, like, where can you see God's fingerprints at work? Where have you been shaped by paths that you didn't plan on taking? How has he provided for you in ways that you never expected? Or how has he been the one who has carried you through those times when there's only 1 set of footprints? Or maybe as you trace those stories, what might God be preparing you for next? As I look back over my story, one of the things that I keep noticing is not just God's guidance, but his presence. Not a God who has stood at a distance and watched and waited for me to figure things out, but a God who, through all of that, has walked with me. Through the uncertainty, through the fear, through the moments where I felt completely unqualified. And that's at the heart of the whole Christian story, I think, because it says that God doesn't just write the story of humanity from afar. He stepped into it. In Jesus, he entered our crooked world and took on our weakness and our fear and our insecurity and our sin and carried it all the way to the cross. Which leads us to communion today. Communion is a time where we remember just that, that God entered our world, that he stepped in. He didn't just stand back and go, well, humanity's stuffed. I'm just going to watch them and see what happens. No, he stepped in and he took all that on and he worked with us to write a story through many crooked lines. So as we share communion today, you might like to hold your own story before God, and the parts that both make sense and the parts that don't. The parts where you felt strong and the parts where you felt completely undone. The bread reminds us that Jesus gave his body for us, and the cup reminds us that Jesus shed his blood for us. And as we come to him in communion and thank him for both of those, we can also reminisce on the fact that he has stepped into our world and stepped into our story to help us through the difficult times and the great times. And so we come to him and remember him and thank him for it. Not because we have it all figured out and we can like see this big long timeline and go, I see exactly what God's done. But because we trust the one who enters our messy world and walks with us. I'm going to invite the stewards to come and prepare the bread and the cup for us now. And I invite you to come forward and receive from them and take them back to your seat. As you do, grab the bread, hold on to that, eat that, hold the cup and don't drink it yet. We're going to drink that together as a unified action. But as you do, eat the bread in your own time and just thank God for how he's moved in your life and present your story to him and just say, God, thank you. Or even if you aren't in that space yet, say, God, can you just remind me all these places where your fingerprints have been? But come forward and receive the elements. Micah just leaned over to me and said, what does daily bread mean? But it's basically what we've been talking about this morning. God's provision each day, the things that we receive from him that allow us to get through the day. The provision he gives us so that we can survive, the things that he gives us. Why don't we drink together and thank him for our daily bread? Let's pray. Jesus, we thank you so much for the cross and how it shows us that you don't just watch us from afar, but that you actively step into our world to save it. And God, thank you that you are still working today, working with us in all of our lives. God, we thank you for your provision, your guidance, your daily bread. Thank you for being faithful, working to shape us and lead us through all points of our lives. God, as we reflect on those things this morning, help us to learn to trust you. Thank you, Jesus. Amen.